Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. What's shaking out there? It's another toasty evening here in the desert, a typical hot August night, a little breezy, and you know what word we use around here for a hot desert wind, but it is a great night to stay inside in the AC or crank it up in your car or the cab of your big rig and get comfortable because we'll have some fun over the next 4 hours. Before I forget to mention it, tomorrow night, less than 24 hours from now, something unusual will be seen in the night sky. Not just a full moon, not just a blue moon, not a mere supermoon, but a blue supermoon. It won't actually appear to be blue or bluish in the sky. It marks a month in which there are two full moons. And in this case, the blue moon is in much closer proximity to Earth, so it looks larger in the sky. Get outside, take a peek tomorrow night, put a sticky note out to serve as a reminder. But tonight, stay right where you are, and here's why. Earlier this month, the Major Chiefs organization did something totally unexpected, at least by me. A friend of ours named Dustin Slaughter wrote a piece about it in his online publication, the UAP Register. He writes, the Major Cities Chief Association, MCCA, whose membership consists of police chiefs and commissioners from over 70 of the largest law enforcement agencies in the U.S. and Canada, produced a well-researched, highly detailed guide for its police executive membership on unidentified anomalous phenomena, tacitly acknowledging the existence of UAP. Now, what's so unusual about that? Well, much like our military, our universities, airports, and other esteemed institutions, the police in general, law enforcement in general, as an official institution, does not admit to taking UFOs and UAP very seriously. They do, but they don't. Don't admit it, that is. I know when I started chasing this topic decades ago, if someone were to call the cops back then to report a UFO, they will keep you on the line and keep you talking, but mostly keep you talking just long enough to figure out if you're a danger to yourself or to others. In other words, they want to know whether you're a wacko, you're crazy. Things have changed a bit since then. There are so many huge and historic UFO cases that involve police as witnesses that I think it's probably harder for law enforcement to ignore it altogether. But for the major chiefs to come out and just say it, spell it out in black and white, here's what you should do to handle this, that's a big deal, in my view. And it kind of sets up what we're going to jump into in the first half tonight, cops and UFOs. A couple of career law enforcement professionals in Arizona have set up an organization, UAPPD, love that title, where law enforcement meets the unknown. That's their slogan. A group to take reports from law enforcement, to interact with law enforcement about UFOs, UAP, cryptids, paranormal, you name it, and also to serve as an outreach between UAP research and law enforcement, a resource. The two co-founders of UAPPD will be my guests for the first 2 hours tonight. Marianne Robb and Dave Rich will join us just a couple of minutes from now. Should be a lot of fun. In the second half, we kind of pull back the scope of the discussion to an even broader view, a panoramic examination of the bigger picture. You know how I'm always yammering on this program about my quest to find what I call the unified theory of weirdness, some sort of a structure of reality that might explain how all of this weirdness might fit together. UFOs, alien abductions, psychic phenomena, ghosts, cryptids, crop circles, ancient mysteries, synchronicities, a hot spot here, a vortex there, you name it. Can they all coexist in some sort of a way that makes sense? Turns out there are a lot of other people who are on that same journey looking for the unified theory of weird stuff. They take a dive into studying ideas and phenomena that are simply too weird to be true, and they kind of wallow in it, as I've done. Matt Vaughn is a psychotherapist, artist, musician, podcaster, investigator, and author who's been chasing these strange subjects for most of his life, high strangeness. He's written this massive treatment, My Cosmic Trigger, it's called, and it's one heck of a read, so much to absorb. I know you're going to enjoy what he's uncovered about how all this stuff might fit together and what it means for the rest of us coming up 2 hours from now. I mentioned about that report issued by the Major Police Chiefs Association. Well, we have it posted on the Coast to Coast website. Webmaster Lex Lonehood and I have included it in this week's edition of NAPS News, wherein items and oddities are culled from various media around the world. You can find it, of course, on the Coast to Coast AM website, the entire report from the Chiefs organization. Among the other stories there tonight, a piece from the debrief about a new study that tells us not to worry so much about AI. It's based on a recent study which suggests that fears of artificial intelligence morphing into, say, Skynet or something worse are likely exaggerated. I kind of hope that study is right. Color me unconvinced for now. There's also a mind-bender of a story about metaphysical experiments that can be done to, in effect, test our understanding of reality, kind of a fitting precursor to our second half guest tonight. Also, an interesting report about an ancient civilization that might be the real inspiration for the legend of Atlantis, an update on patients with chronic pain, you know, something that I've covered on this program a few times over the years. I've also done some work wearing my television reporter hat on this topic. Chronic pain patients are not the cause of the opioid epidemic, nor should they be viewed by their doctors as drug users or abusers. Millions of Americans, as we know, suffer with chronic pain, and it's likely going to get worse as our population ages. But the medications that have worked for centuries to control pain have been cut back or cut away altogether for so many of these people, and their lives have been ruined as a result. Many of them have resorted to suicide, as we've reported previously. Those stories and more in NAPS News. And while you're on the website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. The cost is 15 cents a day if you subscribe for a year. It gives you access to a huge archive of programs and interviews, including the Art Bell Vault, classics, all of them. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want, and it's a great deal. So, too, is a subscription to Beyond Belief. That's George Norrie's television program, wherein George interviews fascinating guests on scintillating topics, similar to what he does so well here on the radio. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the barn owl. Put on a pot of Joe. Slide your bod into those silky summer jammies and your toes into your best bunny slippers. Plop yourself down in a comfy spot. Turn down the lights and turn up the radio, because we are about ready to rumble. In a moment, UAP PD, Marianne Robb and Dave Rich. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Earlier this year, I was fortunate to be invited to this huge conference in Palm Springs, Contact in the Desert, along with my colleague George Norrie. It was a lot of fun. But while walking around in this vast vendor area looking for UFO stuff to buy, stuff that I obviously do not need but wanted anyway, this young lady walks up and plops a business card in front of me. I just took one look at it and was hooked. I didn't need a lot of explanation because the top of the card read UAP PD. I thought, well, that's a pretty cool moniker by itself. The woman who handed me the card was Marianne Robb, and she explained in a quick burst of energy that her organization works with law enforcement, current and former, and with UFO organizations on how to handle, process UFO and UAP reports and incidents. And I have since learned that this organization they created does a lot more than that. Marianne Robb is a retired police officer, had 34 years as an officer in Arizona, gained her experience as a patrol officer, then detective in arson and property crimes and narcotics, and a crime prevention officer. She joined MUFON in 2015, became a field investigator, then became an instructor for MUFON's boot camp, teaching advanced interview techniques and evidence collection. Her co-founder, Dave Rich, is now a retired police officer who had 25 years with law enforcement in Arizona, started his career in patrol, worked up to gang detective, worked in homicide, sex crimes, narcotics, all the tough stuff. Dave also joined MUFON, worked as a field investigator, and became an instructor in their boot camp and symposium. They created UAP PD. Marianne and Dave, welcome to Coast for the very first time.
Thank you, George. It's so wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Dave, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks.
Excellent. Good. So I want to ask you first how you are both drawn to MUFON. And I guess what I did not read in any of the material that was given about your organization was whether or not either of you had your own experience, whether someone in your families had an experience. And that's what took you to Arizona MUFON, which, by the way, I've spoken, met with those folks. That's a great organization, one of the best in the country. Marianne, let's start with you. Did you have some reason to be drawn to MUFON in the first place?
Actually, I haven't. It was my late husband that was into researching UFOs, and he was just very, very interested in the topic. He went to his first the International UFO Congress back in 2014, and he was hooked. He loved it. It was fantastic. I said, you know, go ahead, enjoy, have a great time, which he did. About a few months later, he asked if I would go to a MUFON meeting. He met the state director and the assistant state director of Arizona MUFON, and he asked me, would you come to at least one meeting? Well, as a police officer, you know, I'm skeptical about everything. Went to my first meeting, and I was expecting, you know, tinfoil hats and people kind of mocking the UFO community. But let me tell you, it was the most amazing meeting that I ever went to. Kathleen Martin was the speaker. And at that point in 2014, the end of 2014, I was like, wow, this is really something. Ever since then, I kind of just hit the door running and been with part of MUFON ever since. And like we said, we do teach the boot camp, and we teach advanced interviewing techniques to folks looking to be field investigators.
Dave, same question. Did you or someone in your family have an experience before you ended up going to MUFON and getting hooked?
No, George, I lost a bet. No, I'm just kidding. I actually I had an experience earlier, well, partway through my career, not with a UAP, but with more of a paranormal thing. But I happened to work, one of my duty assignments was at a school as a school resource officer, where I worked with the state director for Phoenix MUFON. And just through casual conversation, I had been intrigued in all things paranormal for most of my life. And I never really had even thought about MUFON until I struck up a conversation with Stacy Wright. And she kind of informed me about everything, and I kind of started going to the meetings and kind of got hooked on. And ironically, I didn't really even know that Marianne, even though we had worked together for like 20 years, I didn't really realize that she was as affiliated with it as she was until after I started going and we kind of started fleshing it out.
So you go to a meeting and you see her there and you're going, what the heck are you doing here?
Well, yeah, kind of.
You know, it's interesting. The last time I spoke to that group, I know Stacy, and that's a great group. The last time I was there to speak to a group in Phoenix, there were some cops in the audience from Las Vegas that I didn't, they weren't in uniform or anything. They didn't know that they were there. They had come from Las Vegas to attend that meeting and were kind of incognito. But I know from all the conferences I've been to over the years, there are a lot of police who show up at these things, have an interest in the topic. They don't try to stand out or draw attention to themselves, but you know, I've worked with law enforcement for 40 years, and I know for sure at every level, local cops, state troopers, highway patrol, Native American police, up to FBI, DEA, Secret Service, there's always a level of interest at all those levels of law enforcement, whether they want to admit it or not. Marianne, have you experienced that as well?
Oh, definitely. And that's why we started UAPPD is we have officers, law enforcement, and we also have first responders that have shared stories with us. But that's it. They come to these meetings. They want to hear, wow, there are other people out there that have had the same experiences I have, and they're probably wanting to share their story. They want to get their story out to the MUFON community or other people in the UFO community. But they're afraid of the stigma. They are afraid to be ridiculed, and they're afraid that if, oh my gosh, if my supervisor hears what happened, I could lose my job. And with our organization, we want them to share their stories with us, and we make sure they understand is that if they would like to remain anonymous, 100%, we will never identify them in our stories. We'll just say a law enforcement officer from California or Nevada or Arizona. We will never identify them by name or by actual department. We just want them to give us a story and get that stress off of them, knowing that there is an organization out there that is taking all of this serious, and we want them to please share their stories with us.
Well, I want to get into sometime in the next hour and a half about the kind of reports that you get, the nature of the information that comes your way. But I want to ask this first. Dave, while you're on active duty, are there instances where, separate from your personal experience, where UAP are reported, where officers talk among themselves, where something has happened, and maybe it doesn't get investigated? There's no official file that comes up. It's just something that people see, and they are still, even officers who've been on the job a long time, are reluctant to get into it in an official way?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, my big sighting, big interaction was I was on duty when it happened, but I had received calls about lights in the sky. And I think what, like Marianne was touching on, there's a stigma that's associated with whenever you see something. I think everybody that's out there, whether you're a first responder or not, if you've seen something, you know that feeling of, am I going to be believed or am I not going to be believed? When it comes to law enforcement, that stigma takes on a new trend or a new take because of the fact that we are, so much of our career depends on our credibility and our ability to come forth and be impartial and honest with what we're talking about. So when you start seeing things that you can't understand, and I know for a fact that officers have, as I was one of them, when you get confronted with that moment of, what do I do? Because now I'm literally seeing something that I was called to go investigate. People are expecting me to come up with an answer, and I am, you know, dumbfounded. I'm stuck. Like, where do I go from here?
And for your incident, whatever happened to you, you can tell us briefly if you want, or as much detail as you want, but was there an official report that was made? Did you have to fill out paperwork?
Yes and no. There was an official investigation done, and at the end of that investigation, I was called upstairs and accused of lying, even though I had video and audio evidence of a ghost calling 911.
Is that what it is, a ghost calling 911?
Yes.
Well, you got to give us those details. What happened?
Well, it's kind of a long story. I don't know how much time we got. But
we're going to go to a break in about 3 minutes. So take that 3 minutes and see if you can cram it into
that. Okay, yeah, this is a longer story than that. But 3 minutes, I'll get it there. So I was working at a high school on a Saturday at 11:54 in the morning. We got a 911 call to the front desk of the school. Sounds like a little girl's voice that says, I'm scared. Units get dispatched to the school because of the 911 tape says that it's from the front desk of the school. Officers go, make entry through the front. It's obviously a Saturday. There's nobody there. We use this thing called a Knox box key, which allows us to get access to the school. Search the entire school. There is nothing there. I end up getting involved because I'm the SRO at the school at the time, and I do a full investigation up to and including pulling the video from the security camera that is showing right where that camera is. I have a recording of the 911 tape that I give over to MUFON for them to analyze. I look at the entire video, and I can say with 100% certainty that there was nobody at that phone when it called 911. We ran down every possible lead up to and including finding out, did anybody tap a phone line, call from a different line and try and route it in. We had the voice analyzed to see if it was like a computer-generated voice, if there's anything that we could find about it. But the bottom line is we were left with no possible reasonable answer as to what made that 911 call. And the thing that's very interesting with it is it was a, you know how like sometimes you'll hear like EVPs and stuff like that, and it's like a person will ask a question, and then the answer comes like 30 seconds later? This was actually in response to the 911 operator. She asked specific questions, and this voice answered those questions immediately as if they were having a conversation. So that's it in a nutshell.
So you write this all up. You put it in a report. You make it, as I would imagine, as conservative and rational sounding as possible. You submit it, and then you get called upstairs and chewed out for it?
I didn't even get the report completed. I got called upstairs. A sergeant called me in an office and said, what is this? I started to explain it. He said, you're lying. He said, you need to just shut your mouth and not talk about this. We exchanged some words, and then I left.
Is there a document so you didn't submit the report. Is there a document that still exists from what you wrote up, or you would not be able to make that public?
No, there is not a document that exists anymore. However, I do have the 911 tape and the video recording that I kept.
I guess you could, now that you're retired, you could write that up. Have you?
Yeah.
I'm really I'm really curious about how the department reacted, how your superiors reacted, and whether there was a policy during the time when you were active duty, both of you. But we're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we'll jump into your own experiences, what policies existed then and whether they've changed. And then we'll get into some of the historical cases that the two of you investigated. There are some big ones. Marianne Robb and Dave Rich, co-founders of UAPPD, are my guests. Marianne, let me ask you this. During your time as an active duty police officer, did your department have a policy written, official or unofficial, about UFO incidents? I mentioned in my yammering here about when I started on this topic long ago is that they really did keep people on the line long enough to find out if they were crazy and a danger to themselves. But was there ever a policy that you know of then or now about how to handle those kinds of calls or cases?
No, nothing police-wise. I don't know if any agency in this country has a policy or procedure on how to handle a UFO call. Gilbert, or the agency we work for here in Arizona, we definitely didn't have one. The one thing is, my team members knew that I was part of MUFON, and what I did, I've had people from MUFON ride along with me. So they knew who I was. They knew what the organization I was with. So if there was any type of interesting call, whether it was a light in the sky or maybe a paranormal incident or anything like that, they would call me, and I would go ahead and take care of the call. But just to have a policy, no. Now, I know back in this, I believe it was in the 60s, that the fire department, right, the National Fire Procedures, actually had a chapter for crashed UFOs. Unfortunately, of course, they took it out of that manual, and it's not in there anymore. But it was very interesting that back in the day, they actually did have a policy on a crashed craft.
Dave, you're probably aware that, you know, the U.S. Air Force, which has been anti-UFO throughout its history, basically, not wanting to admit there's anything to it. The Air Force Academy, back decades ago in the 70s, they had a chapter. They had this physics textbook where they're teaching the best and brightest future pilots, aviators. Look, in the course of your career, you're probably going to come into contact with one of these things. And they said, you know, there are multiple types. We think these things have been here for thousands of years. Of course, when the public finds out that this chapter exists, the Air Force pulls it because their official line is there's nothing to this. I wonder if there's anything like that for law enforcement. I had the same kind of question I asked Marianne, whether you're aware of any policy. And in light of this new Major Chief's document that came out, it almost feels like maybe there's progress being made since the days when you were active duty.
Yeah, I think there's definitely progress being made. While I was working, there was no policy or anything like that. The nearest thing you would get is kind of like the old proverbial try to fit a round peg through a square hole, where you would get the call, you would respond to the call, you would take down the information that you would get from whoever the witness is, the reporting party, whoever it is, and then for the most part, you're just documenting it. So you're writing up, hey, you know, they saw lights in the sky off to the west. And you would write a report, you would submit it as almost like what we would call an unknown troubles call or, unknown incident call. And it would become an information only report, because at the bottom line is, once you wrote it up, you would submit it to records. Well, it wouldn't go anywhere because we wouldn't submit it to anyone. There was no policy for us. Like, who do you give it to? You got the government who's saying they don't exist. We got people telling us, hey, I'm seeing something in the sky. Numerous officers throughout history have witnessed things that they couldn't explain. They're writing these reports, and the reports go nowhere because there's nowhere to send them. So what we're trying to do is, part of what UAPPD is trying to kind of do is help establish some sort of rules or some sort of policies or some sort of parameters that an officer, when he sees something, can he get that information to a group like MUFON or some other organization who could then follow up with the investigation? Ultimately, that's kind of one of the things we would like to do outside of just UAPs or UFOs, but even to the paranormal and cryptids. I mean, we're getting stories from officers from all three genres of things that they're encountering, and more than just providing them an outlet where they can talk about it, because they're still having the trauma of seeing these things when they're called and responding to these calls. we're also trying to document it and kind of help formulate some sort of plan of where do we go from here sort of thing.
Marianne, I'm sure you're familiar with the Navajo and the kinds of cases that they've investigated. Jonathan Dover has been on this program before, and, you know, they took it seriously. Even as weird as things get, you know, the UFO mystery is much broader than just objects that appear in the sky, as you know. Give me a sense of how it works for your organization, how many calls you're getting now. Is the word out among law enforcement, at least in Arizona? You're getting these calls, and then you pass it on to MUFON. Does it work in reverse, too? Do they pass things back to you after they investigate, and then you share it with law enforcement community, or what?
Well, first of all, we know John and Stan very well. They're really good friends of ours. When they come down to the Valley area, they come over. We talk about different cases that we have. As a matter of fact, Dave had one, and we talked about it, and we discovered it's a good possibility that there was a skinwalker seen at an investigation that we did. MUFON, when it comes to the law enforcement, they will talk to us. They feel very comfortable, law enforcement officers, coming to us and say, yes, hey, during my career or still while they're still working, I have seen something I can't explain, and I just want to talk to you about it. And they'll contact us, and we'll talk to them, whether I will go out to whatever city they're in or whatever state. If they feel the only way they can talk to us is in person, I'll be more than happy to travel wherever I need to go to get the report and help that officer out of whatever they saw. MUFON, and the reason I'm saying that law enforcement will only really speak to us because we are law enforcement officers. As Dave likes to say, I would take a bullet for him, he would take a bullet for me, I would take it for another police officer. So they know they can trust us, that we are not going to ridicule, we're not going to make fun of them. Now, when we do our reports, when officers contact us, and we're getting some reports, we would love to get a lot more, and that's why thank you for having us on the show, that we want officers, law enforcement, and first responders to understand we are here for them. So they can contact us, and we can, you know, take the report. If there's something where they say there's a light in the sky or whatever, we will not give it to MUFON. We do not. We will do our own investigation if there is one that needs to be done. We don't share what we have with MUFON because there is a trust between law enforcement officers that we will keep it between us, and especially if they want to remain anonymous. Now, there's a story that there was a report from Kienta, Arizona, which is up in the Navajo Reservation, where the report was sent to MUFON first because these first responders didn't know where to go. So they did go to Arizona MUFON. MUFON tried to do an investigation and talk to these first responders and police officers, but nobody would talk to them. So they shared the story with me because of UAPPD. I was able to get a hold of both first responders, and the one said, I won't talk to you over the phone, but I'll talk to you in person. Well, the next day I'm headed up to Kienta and meeting with her in person. I got the full story, and then she also showed me where this occurred, plus she shared other stories that she has had of sightings in the Monument Valley area.
Yeah.
So we just keep it between, you know, law enforcement. We don't share it with MUFON, but if MUFON has a case of something with law enforcement or first responders and they would like to share it with us, we would love to have, you know, those stories. It would be great.
Well, good. I mean, we are posting links to your organization online. I hope there are some officers listening tonight, former or current, and we'll check it out, take a look at the stuff, the cases that you've got on your website already. And I know a lot of those folks have had their own incidents because, you know, I mentioned I worked with law enforcement for 40 years at every level. And although the relationship between reporters and lawmen, law enforcement professionals, is often antagonistic, I've made friendships, and not just casual friendships, but like lifelong friendships with some of these ex-cops, now ex-cops. And they will share things with me, experience that they've had, and they will also share the idea, the conversations that they have while on duty. I know that there are a lot of incidents that never make it into a report. I say this not in a pejorative way, because but lawmen, cops, at least in this community, are gossips. There's a police grapevine that will spread a UFO story quicker than we can get it on the air, and it goes all over the place. There was an incident in Las Vegas 15 months ago, and it went all over the department. I got calls from officers I hadn't talked to in years about this incident, and that's why we took it seriously, is because the police took it seriously. Is there an ongoing interest now? I know you're just getting started, but can you give me a sense of the level of interest in the topic among your colleagues in law enforcement, both current and retired? Dave, you first.
Well, I think it goes without saying that there's going to be a level of interest, because an officer who sees something, whether it's a firefighter, police officer, first responder, anything like that, when they see something, they're going to know that they obviously saw it. They're going to trust their eyes. They're going to trust their training. They're going to trust their background. They're going to trust the evidence that's in front of them. So I think there's a lot there for an officer or a firefighter or first responder to digest. The area where it becomes a problem is, like, we'll talk to certain people about it. We'll talk to other officers about it. If you have a level of trust with them, they may talk to you as well, or talk to, like, a confidant or a friend that they know, somebody who's not going to ridicule them. The dilemma comes in with what we call the stigmas associated with law enforcement, stigmas associated with seeing something that's unknown. And that's part of what we do with our presentations that we've presented to a bunch of different organizations, is we talk about the stigmas and why do officers, first responders, not talk about it. And a lot of it stems from, you know, it's funny because, like, the majority of the time, people think that the reason officers don't come forward and talk is because it's part of some big grand conspiracy that's in place, where we're working with the government to try and keep all of this information hidden. It actually has nothing to do with that whatsoever. And it has to do more with what I touched on earlier, with is the questions of our credibility. As a police officer, any investigation that I get involved in comes down to two things. What evidence do I gather? And then my credibility, as if, am I telling the truth about it? As an officer, I have to be very, very careful about what will make somebody question my credibility. So I think a lot of times when officers see these things, the moment that they come to the realization, do I tell somebody, do I not tell somebody, all of these ideas start flooding their head of, where is this going to get me? Because we're always thinking, what is the ramifications of what I do?
Sure.
So we have to be very guarded with who we talk about. Like I said, you're a very well-known individual who's known among this community, so I have no doubt that officers would come up and talk to you about it. But the average reporter for, like, a ABC, NBC, CBS channel, we're never going to say anything to them, because exactly what you said, it's a very antagonistic relationship. I've had, you know, not involved in anything to do with anything paranormal, I've had newspaper reporters call on my desk when I was working homicide, asking all sorts of questions. And the only thing I would tell them is, hey, you know what the rules are, call the PIO. But they're always trying to, you know, get that dig, you know, dig for that more information. When you get that type of reporter who doesn't really have a background like you do in things like that, in the unknown, an officer's going to look at that and go, like, well, I'm not going to waste my time talking to them because I don't trust them. I don't know where they're going to go with this information, where they're going to take it. So that's why that's how Marianne and I get the people to come up and talk to us for that very reason, is they trust us. They would trust somebody like you. They would trust somebody like Marianne, myself, another first responder, somebody that they went to the academy with, or one, maybe somebody that's on their squad. But when you start branching outside of that, it gets very sticky or dangerous for people to come, or officers to come forward and say things. And that's where I think a lot of the dilemma comes from, is these officers have these stories and they don't really know who to turn to that they can trust, that they can actually talk about this for. And that's what we're trying to kind of establish here, is because we do have a number of stories right now, not as many, like Marianne said, not as many as we would like, but we have people that are coming forward and talking to us about stuff. And a little interesting thing that we noticed is a lot of it has to do also with what agency, because we have, you mentioned John and Stan, we have buddies of ours that work for one of the reservation PDs, and they came forward with, like, the three of them came forward with like six or seven stories about stuff ranging from everything from lights in the sky to skinwalkers to little people to all sorts of stuff, a haunted mission. But they looked at us and said, well, we have no problem talking about it because on the res, that is the culture. This is stuff that is accepted. When you get off the res, the paranormal is something that people don't really buy. A lot of times they look at it and say, I don't believe that stuff. And that's where a lot of the hang-up comes in, where the officers, where they try and find who do I trust to talk to in that environment, if that makes any sense.
I always think of law enforcement folks as credible, certainly more credible than Uncle Jed out behind the barn kind of a thing, credible in terms of witnesses, because you're trained to keep your eyes open and see what's going on. I guess, Marianne, you have to be worried about you're going to have to testify. I mean, I'm sure you had to testify and narcotics cases maybe and maybe homicides where you got to worry the cross-examination from the defense gets into, oh, aren't you the officer who reported something about a skinwalker or seeing a flying saucer, attacking your credibility, right?
That's exactly it. And that's one of the things, again, that we talk about with the stigmas and the stuff that Dave talks about during our presentations. First of all, people don't know, but it takes a good year to about a year and 3 months of training from the first time you walk into an auditorium to take that written test to become a law enforcement officer to the day that you're handed the keys off of FTO, which is field training. So you dedicated your life for a little over a year of training to become a law enforcement officer. So that's number one, that people are like, I don't want to put that in jeopardy. So, yes, when it comes to going to court, one of the stories that Dave likes to tell, which is true, you're at court of law, shoplifting case, easy shoplifting case. You've got the guy dead to rights. You've got 12 jurors on the stand there, and the defense attorney comes up and says, well, officer, isn't that true that you said you saw Bigfoot a couple weeks ago? Well, yeah. What does a law enforcement officer does before he testifies? He stands up there in front of the judge, puts his hands on the Bible, says, you know, I'll tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. Well, when you're on the stand and the defense attorney asks you, did you see a Bigfoot? Well, of course, yes, I did. I have to tell the truth. Well, the defense attorney looks at the jury. You just need one juror to go, wow, what a crackpot. You know, this officer saw a Bigfoot, seriously? Well, that juror's going to go to the other 11 jurors and go, do you really, that guy is a crazy person.
Right.
So what happens? The jury finds the defendant not guilty. He gets off on the crime.
Yeah.
The defense attorney is going to talk to all the other defense attorneys that he knows and kind of laugh
cop will become
about
a target.
What you just said on the stand.
Right. Marianne and Dave, we need to take a break. We're talking about UAPPD. Coming back, we'll get into some specifics, and maybe some officers out there who are listening might want to call in toward the bottom half of the next hour.